A perfectly Southern gentleman. When I think of my father, an original story for Appaloosa Radio. I am not a Southerner. I have never eaten grits or hog's jowl. I have never had the vegetable plate special at DD's Peach Blossom Cafe. I would never spend a day watching a stock car race. I prefer organic green tea and almost never use sugar. I went to Myrtle Beach once and have no desire to ever return. I don't know the words to Dixie and have no desire to see the South rise again. I am not now, nor have I ever been, a Southerner. If I have any nationality, it is German, or more precisely, European. But I am of Southern origin. My dad was born in Mississippi from a landed family with long Southern roots. His historical lineage is a veritable who's who of the Confederate officer corps. My dad graduated from Vanderbilt University in 1936, an institution where young men went to become Southern gentlemen. And my father was, by every available indicator, a true Southern gentleman. He spoke six languages, all with that unmistakable slow Southern drawl. He knew Plato, Thucydides, Cicero, and Immanuel Kant. He sang opera and had once performed at Carnegie Hall in New York City. He rode horses at breakneck speed, always sitting ramrod straight with his backside welded into his saddle. I once saw him shoot a 45 right through the center of an ace of spades at 100 yards. His genial politeness and courtesy were his ever-present hallmarks. He would turn bright red with embarrassment when any of his Navy buddies told an off-color joke. He was the classic old-time Southern gentleman. As a child growing up, I never realized how out of place his style was in post-war. Quickly forget the past Germany. Stuttgart was a get-it-done-now city. My dad was a drink-mint-julep and sit-on-the-porch-for-a-while gentleman. His official job was as principal of the American-style high school on the giant U.S. Army base. But he always had several excellent assistant principals and a large staff of supporting folks, so he specialized in public relations and keeping both the parents and the Army happy. It was always much easier to do the latter than the former, but his genteel manner created a sense of assurance. Everything will be all right. No need to worry. Each year at Christmas, he indulged his musical past by organizing a huge concert for bass personnel and the German-speaking community. And thanks to several great music teachers at the high school, the Christmas concerts were always an incredible success. As long as the commanding general and the parents were happy, my dad's job was secure. So he never left. He served at the high school from 1953 until 1991 when, after a huge surprise party, he retired. He died 60 days later, the victim of a massive heart attack. Smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day was probably the root cause. My dad was buried with full military honors at the Punch Bowl, really the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, in Hawaii. He was on the battleship USS Oklahoma BB-37 during the attack on Pearl Harbor. He was wounded during the initial wave of the attack, but organized the rescue of his mates to the USS Maryland, where they took over an anti-aircraft battery that provided effective defense of the remaining ships. He was later awarded the Bronze Star for what he did that day. My dad came to Stuttgart in early 1945 as the commander of a naval vessel. He commanded PT Boat No. 217 on the Neckar River, conducting reconnaissance and naval operations in the region. He was awarded the Navy and Marine Corps Medal for his service there. In 1956, my dad married a German woman, and they bought a small house on the outskirts of Stuttgart. The next year they had me. I was the first and only child. My father treated me like an intellectual colleague. I was reading French plays and Italian poetry by age 6. I loved my father. He was my teacher, and he was my friend. We talked about philosophy, religion, art, music, and political theory. We discussed hundreds and hundreds of topics. He had a rich and active mind. But never once did he ever talk about what had happened at that North Carolina whorehouse in 1939. I never knew he had killed a man. I never knew that he was still listed as an escapee by the new Hanover County Sheriff's Office, that for over a decade he was listed as one of North Carolina's most wanted criminals. But I am getting ahead of myself. After my dad died, I opened the small metal box in which he kept his most important papers. I found his passport and saw that there was no re-entry stamp for the United States. There was his visa for Germany, but I also saw that he had never left Germany. No trips to Italy or France or even the UK. Nope. My dad had stayed in one place, Stuttgart, since 1949. I also found his honorable discharge, Stuttgart, 1949. There were his medals and citations. There was his diploma from Vanderbilt, magna cum laude, in 1936. And there were his enlistment papers for the United States Navy. April 17, 1939. Beaufort, South Carolina. Attached to the enlistment papers was a 3x5 white index card. Stamped on the card was the word expedite and handwritten below the words per sheriff. Strangest of all, in the box was a key. It looked like a jail key, and it had a brass tag attached to it by a metal ring. Stamped into the brass tag was NHC Sheriff's Office 0045. I did not know it at the time I opened my dad's metal box, but then I had all the keys, no pun intended. I needed to understand my dad's life. Yet, it still took me 6 years and many conversations before I learned the whole story. Let me begin my story with my great-grandfather. William Howard Farber had been a Confederate general during the war between the states, who was seriously wounded at Shiloh. He was sent home to Gulfport to recuperate from his injuries and, thus, captured by the Yankees while an invalid in his own home. Never one to succumb to despair and disillusion, he cultivated relations with various Yankee officers and gained their trust. Soon that trust would turn profitable for him. There were large stashes of cotton that the Yankee officers wanted to sell, and my great-grandfather obliged them, keeping an appropriate fee for his services. He used that money to buy cotton mills where the rough field cotton was turned into usable cloth. By his death in 1886, he owned six such mills, all of which were in Mississippi and Alabama. My grandfather expanded the business to 20 operating mills in five states. His focus was primarily turning cotton into clothing, particularly socks. It was to our family's sock factory in New Hanover County, North Carolina, that my 24-year-old father was sent in 1938. Technically, our sock factory was not in the city of Wilmington, actually 6 miles north, but my family always called it the Wilmington plant. He was sent there to learn the business. My grandfather said he was too dreamy and needed more grounding in hard business reality. Even though it was the Depression, our businesses remained solid. Cotton socks were cheaper than wool ones. People economized by moving down from wool socks to cotton ones, and white socks were gaining popularity as a fashionable look. My father was given a deep, blue-colored cord automobile hardtop coupe when he graduated from Vanderbilt University. It was that very expensive and special car that he drove up to North Carolina to start his new managerial career at our company's plant. When my father arrived at our company's sock factory, we always called it a mill, it employed about 50 employees in a very hierarchical organization. At the top, there was the general manager, and then his five assistant managers. The general manager had a private secretary, and the assistant managers were supported by a single file clerk. This was the executive office, and everyone was white. Everyone in the executive office had graduated from high school. Only my father had graduated from college, but then he was family, and would, everyone assumed, someday be president of the entire firm. On the floor, Where the machines knitted the cotton socks, there were five white foremen. The foremen didn't actually do any work. They just carried the orders down from the executive office to the mill's workers. Below the five white foremen were the five black straw bosses. It was to them that the actual running of the factory fell, unbaling the cotton, the carding machines, the thread machines, the knitting machines, and the packing room. Typically, there were about 30 workers doing the factory's work of making socks. All the factory workers were black, and most were young, in their teens and 20s. Few, if any, had ever attended school beyond elementary school. They worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. No one in the South would ever work on Sunday. My family's business preferred hiring younger employees. First, they would cost less. Second, they were young and less likely to be injured or have health problems. Third, the straw bosses could exploit them, particularly the young women, and most certainly they did. That's the system that my great-grandfather had created. It was the system my grandfather expanded and perfected. It was also the system that my own father was expected to learn and someday use to operate the firm. Odette Crawford. That was the name of the man who my father murdered at Ethel's Place, a black establishment that served cheap liquor and offered even cheaper women. Odette Crawford's uncle may have been the actual owner of Ethel's Place. I don't know for sure. One of the people I interviewed said that he was. But again, I don't know. Odette Crawford was one of the straw bosses at my family's sock factory. I believe he ran the knitting machines, but again, that is not certain information. I do know that he was a large man who had once been a prize fighter. Just as there were Negro baseball leagues, there were Negro prize fighting tournaments that moved from place to place in a circuit. Beyond his work at the sock factory, Odette Crawford was likely a player in a semi-secret world of minor black-oriented crime. Now at the sock factory, the white members of the executive office had almost no direct contact with the black straw bosses and employees. Typically, one of the foremen would be summoned to the office and given instructions which would then be related to the straw bosses and then to the employees. Two separate worlds operating in parallel spaces. I do not now believe that Odette Crawford and my father ever spoke while working at the mill. There is no reason for them to have done so. It was not an issue that arose from their work. It was entirely about the car, the deep blue cord hardtop coupe. It was an unusual and highly prized automobile. It was an ultimate example of success and importance. To drive a cord meant you were somebody. You were important. Very important. As I said, it was about the cord hardtop coupe. The story that I have discovered is that while working at our family's factory, my father stayed at a hotel in Wilmington, and he always parked the blue cord coupe on the street in front of the hotel where the hotel's doorman could watch it. He felt it was safe. No one would bother it there while it was under constant surveillance. However, on colder nights, the doorman moved inside into the lobby to warm his hands and share, just a wee bit, with the night clerk. It wasn't that he had left his post. He could still see out through the hotel's glass revolving door. Just warmer inside. Then, it happened. The blue cord coupe roared off. The hotel's night clerk rushed upstairs to tell my father. My father immediately called the general manager of our factory. In that brief conversation, two names emerged: Ethel's Place and Odette Crawford. Our general manager immediately drove to the hotel and picked up my father. They then drove directly to the whorehouse. About 50 yards from it, under some trees, sat the blue cord coupe. The two men walked briskly to the decrepit door of the place, opened it, and went inside. From across the room, my father located Odette Crawford, pulled out his pistol, and shot him 4 times. 3 of the bullets hit the large man's heart. My father and our company's general manager turned and left the building. My father took out his key, started the blue cord coupe, and drove it back to the hotel. He took the elevator up to his room, unlocked the door, put his pajamas back on, and went directly to bed. Four hours later, there was a loud knock on the door of his hotel room. It was the New Hanover County Sheriff's Office. My father was placed under arrest for the murder of Odette Crawford. In 1939, Wilmington, North Carolina had two kinds of whorehouses: the rougher, cheap ones for blacks, and the better class houses with crystal chandeliers and Persian rugs for the white customers. My dad, the perfect Southern gentleman from an upper class home, had never been in either. Yet he had just killed a black man in a cheap dive for blacks where tricks sold for as little as $1 each. He killed the man because he believed that the man had stolen his car, and in his mind, the punishment was both just and appropriate. I do not know how he would have acted if the car thief had been white, nor do I know how he would have responded had the car been an ordinary Chevrolet or Ford. I do know that the sheriff never asked him whether he did it. I also know that he never spoke to anyone about it after his arrest. His only request was to be able to wear a clean shirt. No Southern gentleman would go to jail in a dirty shirt. The problem, certain gentlemen said only to their closest associates and then in utmost privacy, was Eleanor Roosevelt. She had toured the South along with a bevy of Northern journalists visiting projects funded by the New Deal. Worse, she was writing a report that showed those monies did not reach black communities. Wilmington, North Carolina was a place she had paid particular attention to. She knew the history of the Wilmington race riots just 30 years earlier. How a white mob had staged a violent coup d'etat against a legitimately elected biracial city council, burning, looting, and lynching afterwards. That story was still often circulated in the various civil rights groups of which Eleanor Roosevelt was a member. No one wanted to lose critical funds, and no one wanted Wilmington to be blacklisted from the highly profitable defense contracts that everyone knew were coming. Now, they had a problem. A wealthy white business owner had murdered a black man in front of multiple witnesses and then returned to his hotel room as if nothing had happened. Just a few months earlier, the federal anti-lynching bill had failed by just 3 votes in the United States Senate. 2 of those 3 votes came from Senator Josiah Bailey and Senator Robert R. Reynolds, both of whom were North Carolina's senators. No one wanted more negative publicity. My father was napping in his jail cell when the sheriff opened the cell door and handed him a key. You, my friend, are about to escape. You tricked a guard and then stole this key, which you used to escape. My father followed him to his police cruiser. He told my father to get in, and then he personally drove him up to Jacksonville, North Carolina. Driven by the local sheriff himself. There he bought my father a bus ticket to Beaufort, South Carolina. His parting advice was simple. The United States Navy always has had special respect for Southern gentlemen like you. In Beaufort, my father enlisted in the Navy. In 6 months, he was commissioned as an ensign and assigned to the USS Oklahoma BB-37, which was then based in San Diego, California. In June 1941, President Franklin Roosevelt ordered the Pacific Fleet relocated to Hawaii. My father was serving as a duty officer when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. I am not, now, nor have I ever been, a Southerner. If I have any nationality, it is German, or more precisely, European. But I am of Southern origin, and I now know my own father's story. Am I proud of my father's story? No, but I'm not ashamed. I choose not to live in the shadow of it. One of the best things about being a teenager on a massive American army base is that there are lots of clubs that you can join. I learned to scuba dive in such a club. Now, I live in Maui and run diving excursions for tourists. I have visited my father's grave twice, once by myself and just a few weeks ago with my son. Maybe someday I'll tell him the full story. This original audio story was created using voices from 11 Labs and music from Suno AI, neither of which is covered by copyright privilege. However, the story content is wholly original and thus has privileged ownership rights, including full copyright under the provisions of the United States. This is a work of historical fiction. All the individuals and the events portrayed in it are fictional and do not reflect or represent actual living or historical persons or historical events.